From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Now, a man who lives in the Himalayas meets a scientist from New York, and the meeting changes both their lives in a quite dramatic way. Here's NPR's Robert Krulwich with a story he calls The Last Asian Pygmy and His Friend from Far Rockaway.
When Alan Rabinowitz was 5, maybe 6 years old, his father took him to the Bronx Zoo, to the big cat house with the lions and the tigers and the jaguars. And what he remembers that first time when he walked through the door were the sounds.
All those noises of like 20 cats all together growling and roaring. And that kind of energy, that kind of power fed into me.
If you hear a bunch of cats...
Oh, it gets to my most basic inner being.
That thrill has never gone away. For 30 years now, Alan Rabinowitz has traveled the world protecting wild habitats in Central America, Taiwan, the Himalayas, so that tigers and jaguars might have a future for a little while longer on this planet. That is Alan's job, to help living things make it to the future. Which is why it was so startling when, entirely by accident one day, Alan Rabinowitz met a man, actually it was a group of people, who had decided together not to have a future, who had chosen extinction. For a conservationist who fights for life and continuity, that was a shock, but the shock changed Alan, and here's the story. It starts back in 1997 in Rangoon, the capital of Burma, or Myanmar as it's now called, when Alan wandered into a bookstore.
And I come across a book, an old book that's just hidden away, tiny, thin volume. I barely saw it. I'm glad I spotted it. And it was called the Tarun.
The Tarun are a tribe or race of pygmies who live in Asia on the China-Burmese border.
They were discovered in the 1950s.
And then described in the book that Alan found, and then they disappeared.
Aside from this book, nobody ever heard about them.
So Alan thought, you know, I want to find them.
I wanted to be the first who has seen them in 30-some-odd years.
So since he was going up to that area near the Chinese border for conservation reasons, it was a 600-mile hike up the mountains.
We're talking snow-capped mountains, hiking up in the snows.
And then down those mountains into the valleys, the jungle valleys, and then up again.
3 months of walking one way.
Until finally he got to a canyon described in the book and arrived at the village where the pygmies supposedly lived.
And something was off right away.
Because when Alan asked the locals...
Where are the Tarun?
The pygmies.
They wouldn't answer me.
He showed them pictures from the 60s.
And they got quiet. That was, something was up, and I couldn't quite get it.
Until a few days later, the village headman finally took him up a path to one shack deep in the woods and said...
They're here.
But they look awful.
First of all, they had huge goiters. One of them is clearly very retarded.
But most of all, there were only 5 of them. Because you were expecting to see maybe 50 people or 60 people?
I was expecting to see an entire village of them, because that village originally in the 60s had been all Tarun.
But then it was explained that these people before him were the last intact pygmy family in the valley.
They were the last full family of Tarun left.
And who knows, maybe they were the last full family of Tarun in the world.
And I found that very strange.
So just as he was wondering how to ask them, well, what happened here, one more pygmy arrived. He was a man named Dawi. He was short.
4'8".
But he was different from the others.
He was strong. He was clean. But the thing that got me the most is the look in his eyes.
It was just...
anger. He wouldn't shake my hand.
He wouldn't join Alan by the fire.
He clearly didn't like the fact that we were there.
But unlike the others...
He wasn't scared, and that's what attracted me to him.
Well, that plus Alan's hunch that if anybody could explain what had happened to all those pygmies, it was probably Dawi.
Dawi had what I wanted.
But he wouldn't talk. Instead, he sat in a corner in the dark.
I could feel his presence, just like an animal in the shadows.
And just when Alan was figuring, well, I'm never going to get this thing figured out because he won't talk to me, he smelled an odor coming from his own feet, which were by the fire.
And I didn't even think about how warm my feet were getting. And all of a sudden, one of my sneakers burst into flames, and my foot's on fire. And I jump up and I start dancing around and stomping it. And Dawi is all of a sudden howling over with laughter.
Figuring these white guys, they're like just so dumb.
I really believe that, you know. They can't possibly be here to harm us.
So, by accident, Alan got Dawi's attention. And while they couldn't talk to each other, they could walk together and look together and hunt together.
And we got close.
So, when they finally sat down together with their translators, Alan did ask,
you know, why are there so few of you? You know, I said, where'd they all go?
To which he answered very simply,
well, there are no babies.
So why no babies?
Because our babies are born not good. Now, I didn't know what that meant.
But over the days, Dawi told him,
for many generations, these Tyrone ended up being enslaved by a lot of the groups around them.
Because they were short and different and weaker.
For a while, they lived in caves because they were afraid of outsiders or anything.
And because they were so isolated, they bred only with each other, and too often the babies that came died or weren't right. So the Tyrone got together, and they made a community decision.
To not have any more, that a Tyrone couldn't have a baby with another Tyrone.
And if anybody broke that rule?
The result would be you'd be banned from the village. And if you were banned from the village, it's death. So the threat of what would happen was so fearsome that there were no more Tyrone babies.
Dawi was free to mate with a non-Tyrone, but it was kind of clear that no non-Tyrone woman would have him.
I mean, literally, they'd made a decision as a race to take the race to extinction. I said, did you understand that really by doing that there'd be no more Tyrone? That you'd be gone forever? He said, yes, but we have to do that because we're not good. You don't know how much that word resonates with me.
Because for Alan, being a conservationist, all things are good, certainly good enough to keep on living. And yet, Dawi's words had touched a nerve in Alan. It was a very private nerve.
Dawi's sadness, his answers started just threw me back on my feet so much that I just started talking to him. I just started saying, well, you know, I don't have any children either.
And that was a choice, he said. I chose not to.
I was unhappy, I told him, and sad with a lot of parts of my life, and that my woman wanted a baby, and I didn't know if I should have a baby because I didn't think I was good enough to have a baby.
But as Alan heard himself talking, he realized his worries about becoming a father were so trivial compared to Dawi's.
Every time I tried explaining it to him in a way, I thought, well, he just doesn't really get it. But he got it. He just felt that they were pitiful excuses.
And then when he left the village and then later left Burma and flew back to New York, they remain pitiful excuses. The story that Dawi told changed Alan. Changed him enough that within a year he had some news.
Yeah, about having a child.
Alan had a baby boy. In good part, he thought, thanks to Dawi. But the only way he could say thank you, since Dawi has no phone, no link to the outside world, was to walk back 600 miles into the Himalayas, which eventually Alan did. Though he wondered what would happen when he got there, because he knew that Dawi also dreamed of being a father.
I asked him, I said, do you want a baby? And he said, yeah, he really wants a baby. He wants a wife.
So because he had done this before, this is, after all, what a conservationist does, Alan got the government of Burma to establish the wildlife park where Dawi lives.
And his home is inside the national park.
And what's more?
He has been hired as Mr. Big. He's been hired as the person to bring salt up to all of the people.
And since this is an area where people don't use money, salt is currency there. So Dawi has become one of the richest men in the valley.
So he's doing pretty well, and he's, God, I've seen recent pictures of him. He's all cleaned up. He looks so good in his uniform, but he hasn't married yet.
And so as Alan headed back to thank his friend Dawi, he wondered a little if his thank you might hurt. So he came to the village, and he found his friend.
We kind of, you know, we didn't hug or anything. We shook hands, which is as close to a hug as the Dawi will get.
And then they sat down to talk.
And he asked me how I was, and I was waiting for that. And then I pulled out this photograph of my baby son. And I'd never seen that kind of emotion in Dawi.
And then when Dawi looked at the picture,
he just threw back his head and laughed. And this time it wasn't, you know, a laugh of thinking you're an idiot. This time it was a laugh of, I felt there was a laugh of pride. There was pride there and true happiness that I was getting to do it, even if he couldn't.
That was 3 years ago. Today, Alan Rabinowitz has a young daughter as well as a son. But Dawi, he understands, has lost his mother and lost a sister, and is now almost the very last Tyrone in the valley. Robert Krulwich, NPR News, New York.